Hello, everyone, and welcome to a special bonus episode of Filmstrips, a roadside stop, if you will. I'm Dave Babbitt.
I'm Andrew Kanigeiser, and I drove all the way to, trying to think of a landmark here, where's that big ball of twine, like in the Weird Al song? Somewhere in Minnesota.
The important thing is we're at a nice fine diner, I'm having a cup of coffee, and that one's not actually a lie. So, I mean, really, you know, just sit back, enjoy this on your morning commute, or listening to it over breakfast. I apologize to the long-haul truckers who we disappointed by not having our regular episode out this week, but we do our best on this little program of ours. And
well, I mean, yeah, every now and then Dave and I do mini-episodes, usually because we suffer catastrophic delays or technical failures. But, I mean, we're sort of here today for a smaller episode away from our usual format, which longtime listeners will know is the big game of 6 degrees of separation.
Absolutely. So, yes, it sort of condenses that into a much shorter form. We're playing for time.
Yes, we are decidedly playing for time. But hang on, folks, because we've got some good episodes lined up with some interesting guests. Dave and I have been trying to be social, which you kind of run into problems when you do that, and then Andrew has terrible internet at home, and no one can get their tech to play nicely with each other. But stay tuned, because it is coming.
At least you don't sound like you're running the Chris Farley talk show like I do most of the time.
You know, you can find clips of the Chris Farley talk show on the internet, I bet. And you can also find our website at filmstripspodcast.home.blog, where you can find our full episode archive.
Absolutely. But with that said, I guess the big question is, you know, that you might have right now is, well, okay, fine, if it's not a regular episode, what exactly are you doing in this episode while you ostensibly are choosing to eat, you know, eggs and hash browns first thing in the morning?
Well, I mean, honestly, we looked at an open marketplace and we said, 2019, this is finally the time for two white guys in Canada to talk about movies on the internet.
Yep, absolutely. But for once, it's actually going to be stuff that's playing at a theater near you, right now.
Yeah, a bit more contemporary. I mean, we haven't gone, what's the oldest we've gone back? Was it The Third Man?
I think The Third Man is the oldest we've gone back, which is into the 1940s. Although we were very close at one point to doing the 1930s version of Alice in Wonderland with Cary Grant, but we didn't go down that road quite yet.
Sadly not. But one day we may. Hopefully we see more Cary Grant, because I've learned to love him. But instead, yeah, we're talking about films that are in theaters now. Dave and I, for once, aren't operating on like a 4-week delay, which is why we miss marking all the strange celebrity deaths that keep happening around our show. We avoided the curse in an indirect way recently. We wrapped up an episode and checking Twitter, only then it's not that we talked about Rip Taylor, so he didn't die on account of us, but it did happen in the middle of recording the episode.
Yeah, although, did we not have a conversation off-air recently about Rip Taylor with, I think, was it James?
Maybe. I think we were all trying to remember if any of us could identify why anyone knows who Rip Taylor is.
Yeah, and the answer we came to was Wayne's World 2. It's always Wayne's World 2.
Exactly. Crossing our T's and dotting our lowercase J's. Sadly, we're not even here to talk about films as recent as Wayne's World. In fact, I broke my habit of grouchy agoraphobia recently and went to the movies. And Dave, I understand that you did too.
Yes, now I understand that this is maybe a slight more rare instance for you than it is to me there, mainly because I have no social life and, you know, limited responsibilities, it seems like, some days. So I have free time to kill.
I mean, I have no social life either, and I literally live about a 5-minute drive away from a multiplex. But first off, paying $15 to sit in the dark with a bunch of strangers and watch half an hour of commercials, not really my thing. Second, our show, I mean, we clearly are fairly tongue-in-cheek and try to be self-aware about how professional we are. It still takes time. And man, even though my covers of Love is a Battlefield leave a lot to be desired, it still takes time to do. Also, I have one child and another on the way. Life is too short to set aside 3 hours of watching Quentin Tarantino point to himself and say, "Everybody, look at how smart I am."
Well, like I said, I'll definitely agree with you on the responsibilities of fatherhood. Well, maybe not see eye to eye quite on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but we'll get there one day.
One day. I can't believe we haven't talked Quentin Tarantino yet.
I almost feel like at this point, what can we really say or add to the conversation on him that probably hasn't already been said before, but
very true. So, I mean, this is a great week for us. We'll finally strike the iron while it's 2 weeks old in theaters. So, Dave, what did you go and see?
Well, I last night, prior to this recording, I should note here, went and seen a little film by the name of Gemini Man, Ang Lee's latest film. And Andrew, you saw something a bit different, though.
Yes, me and my father, we decided to have a cool guys' night. Tried to go to Nando's. It took us half an hour to get water, so we left, and then went to Men Shu Wok. Very good. And then we ended up going to see Ad Astra, which, funny enough, I thought was directed by Ang Lee all throughout. Because I knew he had a new one, and of the two films, Ad Astra seems much more like a film that Ang Lee would direct than Gemini Man, which, at least from surface appearances, seems to be like a high-tech Bourne Identity.
Well, sort of here. So, I mean, I guess to get into each of these films' respective stories, and again, typically we do spoilers on the show. I think we'll keep our general remarks fairly. I don't know whether we'll say spoiler free, but I think we'll be
Yeah,
maybe a
we're
little.
not getting in depth on these ones the way that we normally do.
So we'll try and tread lightly where we can, but be forewarned, there might be the odd spoiler here or there that pops up throughout it. But yes, so in the case of Gemini Man, the best way I can think to describe it is, you remember the mid to late 90s when there were all those sort of high concept action movies that had sort of a sci-fi premise?
Give me a couple of names.
I would say probably the most prominent one that I think will stick out in most people's minds is John Woo's Face Off, the iconic film starring Nicolas Cage and John Travolta, in which the high concept premise is, yes, they switch faces and assume each other's identities. And of course, suddenly this leads to fisticuffs and a lot of firearms in terms of having to solve the situation.
And Delroy Lindo being lit on fire. Don't forget that it also gives Nicolas Cage the superpower of being able to eat a peach for hours.
It also involves a scene, something that, for whatever reason, of all the things that stick out of my mind from that film, it's the daughter stabbing John Travolta in the leg and then twisting the knife.
Oh, with
I
the
don't know.
butterfly knife, right? Because he gives it to her. Irony. That's Chekhov's butterfly knife right there.
Indeed. I don't know why that moment sticks out, but
I remember some weird detail about like anti-gravity or magnetic boots being used as a prison restraint.
yes, there were magnetic boots on the prison where Nicolas Cage is be when he goes undercover is be as the criminal that ostensibly John Travolta plays in the first 15 minutes is being stored.
Castor Troy. Let's
Castor,
give credit where it's due.
Fair enough, yes. But the point of me, yeah, it's one of those films where, yeah, it's ostensibly a sci-fi movie, but when you look at how it lays itself out, it's not really a science fiction movie.
Yeah, like the same way that Blade Runner sort of is sci-fi, kind of sci-fi distilled in terms of what's meant there, whereas a film like Face Off is closer to something like Paycheck, where it's an action film with a gimmick rather than any kind of exploration of speculative technology.
Precisely. And Gemini Man is basically the same thing. Now, for those of you who've seen the trailer for this film, you'll probably know what the general premise is, but for those of you who don't, the basic idea is that
Will Smith is a 200-year-old robot.
Not quite that high concept. But in this instance, Will Smith is a 51-year-old assassin who's, takes jobs taking out the bad guys for the government, but as with all film assassins, he's choosing to retire at this point in time.
So he's Deadshot without a mask.
Effectively. But what he ends up discovering is, well, due to a series of circumstances, nefarious forces high ranking up in the government decide that he needs to be eliminated, and they decide to send an assassin after him, who just so happens to be, dun dun dun, his clone, who's actually the young Fresh Prince era Will Smith. In this instance, using a form of digital motion capture technology, Will Smith plays both roles, but it's not the kind of de-aging technology that we've seen in the Marvel movies. The young Will Smith actually is a full-on digital creation.
Okay, so young Will is wholly computer modeling?
Yeah, like Smith was performing on screen, but it's not a case where they just outlaw, mapped on his face and then sort of removed the lines and tried to de-age him. Literally, it is a physical puppet or a digital puppet that is being modeled after the older Will Smith's performance in order to look like the young Will Smith, the younger Will Smith there.
Okay, so it's not quite the same as, say, Andy Serkis as Gollum.
It's basically that approach, but it's not like, again, for those who've seen the Marvel films with the de-aging they've done with, say, Nick Fury and Captain Marvel, in that instance, to make it look like Sam Jackson from the mid-90s. It's, in that case, Sam Jackson's not wearing, like, a motion capture suit when he does that.
It would be awesome if he did, though.
Yeah, but in this instance, it's basically, yeah, they are more or less, the way, probably, I know special effects artists will hate this if they ever hear, it's closer, I think, to something along the lines of, like, Photoshop, where you are reducing and physically manipulating the image that's already there.
Yeah, it's sort of after effect processing versus what seems to be here, like, modeling a 3D model based off a reference into the frame.
Exactly. And yeah, from there, taking that into account, so yeah, the film basically becomes old Will Smith versus young Will Smith, and maybe old Will Smith seeing this as a possible second opportunity to see if he can convince this youngster to tread down the right path. And of course, our villain is played by Clive Owen, who's continued his descent from one-time possible leading man to generic British bad guy.
I know! I wanted to see this movie because I saw Clive Owen in the trailer, and I'm like, I don't know. Like, let's take a moment and reflect on just how awesome Clive Owen can be. Croupier, when I was a teenager, that was my favorite movie, and I thought he was the coolest man on earth. He was the reason I saw Gosford Park at like age 15, and I'm like, I don't understand anything that happened. But then, like, seeing him in movies like Children of Men and Shoot 'Em Up, you know, and Derailed, it's like, you can definitely see a descent here. What's that one with Jude Law and Julia Roberts and Natalie Portman? Is it a Mike Nichols one?
Oh,
And it's all about doing it.
I think it's Closer, was that?
Closer, that's the one. Yeah, I do remember he had that great line where he's, have you ever seen a heart? It looks like a fist wrapped in blood. Doesn't make up for the other 2 hours, but anywho, I guess my first question on anything that uses quote-unquote photorealistic motion capture or modeling, because I'm a longtime PC gamer, and I remember when Max Payne, the first one, came out in 2001, and people are like, I remember PC Gamer had a screenshot, and I remember the caption. It said, remember when we were approaching photorealism? Welcome. And you realize 18 years later, the leaps and bounds that technology has grown. Yet it doesn't always come off perfectly, and when it doesn't come off perfectly, it can be the most jarring thing on earth. So, on a scale of Final Fantasy, The Spirits Within, to The Polar Express, how uncanny is the Valley?
I'll put it this way. This is easily, hands down, the most effective use of that technology that I've seen, because there is very rarely a moment that my eye registered that this was a digital puppet as opposed to an actual person. There's the odd occasional momentary shot where you might see it, but for 99% of this running time,
where the texture fails to load, so he's just a gray smear.
Nothing quite that bad. But here's the thing. As impressive as that technology is to achieve that, that's not the big thing, my big takeaway for what's amazing in terms of technological development.
Yeah, because you are a very lucky film goer indeed, aren't you? Because the big thing about the discourse that I've been seeing, certainly from headlines on the internet, is that the only way that Gemini Man is meant to be seen, by Ang Lee's words himself, is not actually viable for the majority of filmgoers in North America?
Well, and this is the thing. Now, some of you have probably heard of the high frame rate, or the 120 frames per second technology. This is not the first film to use it. Way back when, Peter Jackson shot his Hobbit movies in this format.
And everyone hated them because of that. I remember people saying it looks too soft, like an episode of Teletubbies.
Well, for the five people out there who got to see it, I mean, it was the thing. We were all having to sort of rely on those responses because what could you do? I mean, nobody could actually see it. And it made it a huge question as to, was this a worthwhile investment? Because when you consider this, the fact that they're shooting 120 frames per second as opposed to, or in that instance, it may have even only been 60 frames per second. I can't quite remember. But the point of the matter was, when you're shooting at a higher frame rate, that means there's that many more images you need to actually render effects work on when you're working in a high effects level film like The Hobbit.
Good point.
Yeah,
it's so, like how people say that Robert Redford never could have been a leading man in high def, which I don't think is true. Look at Danny McBride. But, I mean, that is a very important practical consideration because, I mean, you look at, you know, the story about Avatar, where James Cameron wanted to make it for 10 years, but he had to wait until tech got there before he could do it. And it's like, really? And this is the script you turned in? But, I mean, there is that idea where it's like, oh, there's something almost prohibitive about being able to access, like, the true technical form of this film. And that incentivizes viewers to go seek it out in, like, specialty theaters and that.
Well, and this is the thing, like, to be entirely honest, I still haven't seen it in the absolute pristine condition that Ang Lee wants it projected at, because the film was, the ideal form of it should be projected in 4K and played at the 120 frames per second rate. In this case, I saw it 2K and 120 frames per second, which is still amazing, seeing as how I never assumed for a minute that any theater near me would actually be able to physically play the film in its anywhere remotely close to its intended format. Again, I live in southern Ontario in a small town. I'm not near, say, Toronto or the major city centers where you can probably have a pretty good chance.
Yeah, and I live in London, and I'm pretty sure nothing can screen that here. Though, can I say something?
Sure.
A really embarrassing omission as a somewhat film critic. I don't really see all that much. I don't think I've ever seen anything in 4K, and I don't see the difference between Blu-ray and DVD that closely unless it's projected on a big screen. My eyes are failing as I get older.
See, when the switch over from DVD to Blu-ray happened, I immediately could see the distinction. I held off on high def for a while because, as those who might remember, there was the format war between HD, DVD, and Blu-ray, and who was actually going to ultimately win that out. So I wanted to see a clear winner before I invested in that.
Well, but finish the anecdote. Who won?
Blu-ray, folks. It was Blu-ray. But the key point being here,
it was Blu-ray.
Yeah, I mean, I am, again, kind of a sucker for understanding. At least, like, I can't pretend that I fully comprehend technology and the sort of science that goes into it. I am not any sort of, you know, nuanced nerd on that level. But I do appreciate the importance of technology and what it means in terms of practical applications and how this does impact the actual art or what it's like to see a film.
And if you do know things about film technology and you want to correct us, please email your clips to filmstripspodcast@gmail.com.
But I will say this, I didn't go to see this film alone. I went with my father. And if you want evidence about whether, if you have the opportunity to see Gemini Man in 120 frames per second, whether you will notice a difference. The fact that my father, who is by no stretch of the imagination a hardcore cinephile like me, I mean, he is very much the definition of a casual film goer.
Yeah, he seems a lot like my dad, and I think our dads can be very effective litmus tests for the popular appeal of art films.
Yeah, and in this instance, yeah, he noticed the difference. And yeah, when you watch this film, I will say this straight up, it does not look like film. And I know there's going to be a segment of people of quote-unquote purists for whom that will drive them up the wall.
Well, if it doesn't look like film, what does it look like?
The descriptor my father came up with as he was sort of grasping around for terminology to describe it was, it looks like somebody, like they shot this like it was somebody's home movie. And he didn't mean that in a derogatory sense, but it's that sense of there is that smoothness that comes with video. Because, yeah, it's digital video at an extraordinarily high frame rate. The difference is, this is like the single most gorgeous BBC video shot production you have ever seen. I mean, this thing, it looks smooth, it looks crisp, and yeah, you don't have the grain structure of film. You don't have that sort of sense of That sort of distancing effect where you can tell that we're looking at a photographic image in the same way. This looks much closer to almost looking at through a window and seeing that there's a person there. And there's
hey, look, Will Smith is my neighbor.
Well,
I live in Bel Air.
Well, but this is the thing. It's not that far off because suddenly the thing I realized as I was watching is, you know, there was during the 80s in that, and I say there was that BBC video production style quality, but it was true. basically, if you look at the BBC productions, for the most part, they weren't shot on film. They were shot on high-end, what was for the time, high-end videotape.
See, I always wondered as a kid, because I would notice flipping through, any European programming had that smoothness.
Yeah.
And I always used to think it was an NTSC PAL distinction. I remember my sister thought she broke her DVD player because she switched it over to PAL. And I fixed it for her, and I explained, now just remember, if you live in North America, PAL is not your friend.
Well, yeah, and it's the thing where, I mean, certainly that does sort of impact in terms of frame rates and how it plays through. So there is a slight shift that happens with when you convert from PAL to NTSC, NTSC, if I remember correctly. Point being here that, you know, video does look distinctly different, but this film is so incredibly crisp and clear, and the way in which Ang Lee takes advantage of it to in terms of how he shoots this movie is gobsmacking, particularly when it comes to the action sequences, because if you're seeing this thing in 3D at 120 frames per second, he uses quite a bit of POV shots throughout the film where you're on bicycles, you're on motorcycles, the camera's lined up there, and it creates a very different visceral feeling as you're seeing these sequences play out, that this will not exist when you're seeing this play back at a standard 24 frames per second rate. And more to the point, the use of light and shadow, because again, the digital video captures light levels in a much more varied field of vision, like in terms of what the shadow detailing is.
Okay, because that is an interesting thing I've heard in certain films, using digital technology purely for lighting reasons. That is a common approach, and it would be interesting to see that conjunctive with 3D and 4K. I know, was it? Robert Rodriguez, when he was making Sin City, he said that the primary reason for going digital was because you could enhance the chiaroscuro black and white even more. Whereas you're talking, it seems like capturing a much broader range of different kinds of dark.
Well, yeah. I mean, for those of you who remember Michael Mann's film Collateral, which was shot on high-def video back then, again, there's sequences where there are extreme low-light situations that he shot in that movie. And one of the things that of why those sequences work the way they're shot is because with digital video, he was able to use much less light to achieve a much greater effect in terms of being able to peer into the darkness with that those different layers of difference. This is the same thing, but amped up on an even higher degree where, you can see sequences where, we have the digital Will Smith facing off with the real physical Will Smith in a darkened environment, but not a pitch black one. Like, there are different gradient levels of shadow all throughout this. And the lighting is magnificent, where you go from natural lighting to fire on screen, and the way in which the different light interacts on screen in terms of how the image is being captured is just breathtaking to see. And more than anything else, I really, really want to see Michael Mann shoot in this format. I could just imagine him having a field day with this.
You want to see Michael Mann shoot everything.
Yeah, I do. And if he wants to shoot 120 frames per second, by God, let him shoot something in 120 frames per second, people. Point being, though, that the real big sequences where I think people will notice, there's quite a bit of stuff actually set on water in this film, or in water or that. And the way in which the water photography is shot here, it comes across in this format, is stunning. Like, again, the clarity levels of what you see in underwater shots is unlike anything I've seen prior to this. And particularly with the 3D effect, where you see a POV shot of a young Will Smith basically drowning in a pool, is just, again, the viscerality of that sequence is something that would not exist if this had been shot in a conventional format.
Fair enough, but let me ask you this. So, all right, I guess I'm of two minds at the moment, because I get that you're trying to color it a bit, and I think I certainly am picking up on sort of what the appeal of the visuals of this film are, but it's also one of those things, like, as we talk about in upcoming episodes, it's that distinction between the affective and the sort of objective description, where after a point, I mean, you can only say so much without seeing it for yourself and having that shared experiential reference. But
Yes.
maybe the operative question, though, is as a film, though, as a narrative and as a story that you may or may not buy into, what's Gemini Man like? Because if there's no narrative reason to justify that use of that technology, then it does the film become like Martin Scorsese is so afraid of that it's just a thrill ride?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is hands down the easily the dumbest thing that Ang Lee has ever made. Like, shockingly dumb, when you get right down. This thing is dead simple, and yeah, it's a demo reel for his tech that just so happens to have the loose basis of a story there. Now, I will say this, again, giving the credit to the fact that in order that basically in terms of pulling off the idea of a digital puppet of a young Will Smith being put on screen, the format he chose to do this had to make the entire experience of making this 5 times more challenging than you would into than it otherwise would have been.
Undoubtedly, yeah.
So in this instance, I get why in this instance you can at least see something of a narrative justification for this technology in this instance, where at least if I'm gonna show this thing off, I am gonna make this the single most difficult thing to try and achieve and do it on film. And full props to him. On a technical level, this thing is a marvel. Here is, and again, Ang Lee actually shoots some pretty solid action sequences throughout this film. I would still love to see this format applied to something like, for example, those who've seen the Raid films. I would love to see a third part of that series shot on this format and just, go completely gung-ho in terms of, yeah, let's get as visceral and with that camera in there as close as we can and just let the blows really be felt there. That would be fantastic. But for the purposes of what Ang Lee set out to do here, it serves it. But yeah, once this thing hits home video, or if you do not have the option of seeing this thing in the intended format, don't bother. There is no, literally no reason to go see this movie otherwise.
Well, because that's the implicit question that I think I was sort of toeing around. Because I mean, Avatar, for instance, that we brought up earlier, how many people still watch that film on a regular basis on home viewing? And I feel like most of these efforts to deploy technology in radical and inventive new ways usually have very superficial narratives, almost because they're like, well, we need to keep it simple and be as broad-based appealing as possible. But it ends up being that outside of the theatrical or intended exhibition space, there's really not a lot of value in re-encountering these films as narrative objects.
Well, I would say this. This is the second time Ang Lee has worked in the format, because the first time he did was with Billy Lynn's
Oh,
Halftime Ball,
yeah.
which I have not seen. So I cannot judge it, but from the general looks of the trailer for that film, unlike this film, unlike Gemini Man, which is a straight-ahead action spectacle, Billy Lynn Halftime Walk for the most part looks like it's a drama. There are war sequences, but it is first and foremost a character drama, which honestly, I would now be intrigued to go back and watch it if I could in the intended format to see how that works in something that is ostensibly more of a character piece.
Well, but you can't. And I mean, I think there's a certain esoteric value in that, that people can be like, yo, I was one of the 15 people that caught a screening of von Stroheim's Greed or something like that. Or I remember like Chris Marker apparently made a number of films on the Macintosh that they cannot be retrieved and they cannot be converted. They are art objects that now have ceased to be. And that's interesting because the idea of art and textual art is that perpetual openness. Whereas here, it's almost like the technological impetus towards planned obsolescence, that's suddenly colliding with film objects in a way that nobody really foresaw the consequences of.
Well, and I'll be curious to see how things shake out going forward, particularly as things such as, say, filmmaker mode is going to be something that's installed on brand new 4K television sets going forward, where the intent is to remove basically the motion smoothness you would see that most televisions are preset these days too, and which I wish to God they weren't. But putting that aside, I think, what really does remind me though of, I mean, let's be honest here, Andrew. You and I grew up in the era of VHS tape.
Heck yeah, we did.
We did. And we grew up, watching many, many films in this either open mat or cropped pan and scans of panoramic shot movies.
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw a widescreen film at home, I'm like, what the hell? I want my $5 back.
And that was a lot of people's reaction. And, you know, me being a super young nerd who read way too much in his free time, it was like, oh, yes, no, this makes perfect sense. I want to go with it. But, I mean, it was one of those things where, yeah, for a long time, I mean, there's always that question of, even as we're watching films on home video, it's not the same thing as the theatrical going experience. And certainly, while we keep trying to sort of shrink the divide between them, I mean, if there was an entire generation of people who grew up watching films where they were not watching them in their proper intended format.
That's a good point. Because, I mean, the same way that even the idea of film technology almost relying on gimmickry and sort of valorizing the theatrical experience. I'm thinking early uses of 3D, or as we discussed in the Robes, Cinerama. It's the idea that in times of downturn, the film industry responds by giving people a reason to attend the theater and only the theater as their source of entertainment. It just kind of begs the question where, why that's happening now, because as films like Endgame have proven, it's not that box office numbers are dropping. Television is changing with the advent of digital platforms, but I mean, that seems to be a more synchronous kind of development that would work in tandem with the film industry as opposed to the 1950s.
Well, the thing I would say is you're right that the box office hasn't necessarily dipped, but the thing we have to keep in mind that does not equate that audience attendance hasn't dipped, because the reality being that, yeah, audience attendance is way down compared to, say, the golden age of the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Yeah, because movies don't cost a nickel, and you can't get a trolley anymore.
Well, not only, though, that films don't cost a nickel, but again, with the fact that, yeah, we have television, the internet, everything else, films are increasingly fighting to maintain that dominance, which in turn helps lead to the increase in ticket prices. Now, ideally, I would say the better approach to that would be make cheaper films that don't all cost, you know, $200+ million.
That's a start.
That would be certainly a start. And I think, as Jason Blum is showing, there is an audience out there who will pay to see movies that are made on a very modest budget if they're incredibly well made.
Let me stop you there. Who's Jason Blum?
That would be the producer on films such as, most notably, Us and Jordan Peele's previous film to that, Get Out.
Okay, so I am a bad film nerd, because I like both those movies a lot. And yeah, it's almost like that John Carpenter vibe that we've talked about recently, where you don't need a whole lot of resources to execute an interesting and original vision. You just need a little imagination sometimes. And it doesn't always work, but I mean, it's not that suddenly spending 5 times as much on a film is necessarily going to make it better, especially if you're making the kind of film that doesn't need to be $200 million.
Well, and this is the thing. I mean, based on box office revenue so far, I doubt Gemini Man's going to make its money back. So what the long-term prospects for this format is, I know Cameron's shooting his Avatar sequels in it, so I can almost guarantee he will be hell-bent on getting as many theaters converted as possible to be ready to show it in his preferred format. And as much as I still want to see Cameron eventually go down in flames at this point in time, I know that's a little bit mean-spirited to say, but I stand by it.
Well, I mean, it could happen. Maybe the Avatar sequel, he'll just retitle the script from The Emperor's New Groove instead.
Could be.
Hey, it means we get John Goodman.
Yeah. They shot, four of these films together. That's the thing that blows my mind. It's not just they're making a single sequel. They're making 4 of these things at the same time. Like, dear God, man, Cameron.
I was like, who cares? I don't have that kind of time. The same way that, like, everyone's like, oh, man, you know, Dawn of Justice, this legendary 4.5-hour cut of it. Oh, this is the one that's going to make this film a masterpiece. And I'm like, I think it's just fundamentally irresponsible as a studio, as a director, as any party involved with a production that gets to be that level of excess length and largesse, because there is no way that any film studio is going to release a 4.5-hour dreary R-rated hard cut of superheroes. And the fact that anyone even entertained it till it got to that point shows that the studio system has some fundamental problems.
Oh, absolutely, and unquestionably here. I mean, certainly fiscal responsibility in the age of ever-booming technology is something that really needs to be discussed, and I think is the major point. And I find, and again, this is why part of me, you know, not to get dwelling on the Martin Scorsese's recent comments thing, part of the problem I have with listening to any filmmaker from the Hollywood Renaissance when it comes to this is that the reason Hollywood is in the current state it is, in many ways, is because of how irresponsible the film brats of the 70s were.
Yes, there's a reason that most of their biographies have a period where they were persona non grata because they lost the studio they were working for a boatload of money.
Yeah, exactly. And they basically helped engineer the situation where, yeah, major corporations came in and bought up the studios because who could afford to keep running these major money loss endeavors. And that's
I mean, film, we always like it when it's an art object, but it is also an industry and a business first and foremost. So if somebody comes and offers I don't know, Louis B. Mayer, they're like, we'll offer you $200 billion to sell your studio. You think he's gonna be like, no, my art is too meaningful? Or is he gonna be like, yeah, sounds good?
Well, absolutely. And I think, yeah, that's the thing that people tend to forget when you look back through the 1960s. As, yeah, the studio system is dissolving and all these renegade movies were coming out that were really cashing in on the alt crowd and the young crowd. Well, yeah, that's great and fine. But don't forget, what was the films that were paying the bills? It was freaking Sound of Music. And that's not a knock on Sound of Music. I like it as a movie, but it is about as big and mainstream as you get. And it was a huge hit that helped keep Fox going. So, I mean, you can't overlook the fact that, yeah, populist entertainment, even during the quote-unquote Renaissance period, was a huge friggin' factor in things going on. And then meanwhile, you know, we come back to One from the Heart, where Ford Coppola sabotages himself by overspending on a movie that should never have cost even a fraction of what it ended up doing, let alone...
Well, yeah. And I mean, that's a film, though, where its failure is motivated by, we're going to do these things because the tech is available and we can, rather than there necessarily being an organic need for it.
Well, absolutely. And in that instance, this is where I can at least, yeah, give Ang Lee the benefit of the doubt, where I can see at least the rationale for why he wanted to take this gamble in terms of, look, if I'm going to do this with any film on a large scale, this is the technical challenge that's laid down by this movie if we go this road with this technology. And yeah, I want to meet it. So whether it's fiscally responsible of him, I'm not going to sit there and judge on that level. I can at least say that more so than One from the Heart, I get why the choices were made on this one comparatively. But perhaps on a slightly less extreme end of the technological spectrum, you saw Ad Astra lately, which is perhaps not necessarily as innovative on a technical level as, say, Gemini Man is, or at least not anywhere near to the same degree.
Well, it's a sci-fi movie, and it is absolutely gorgeous to look at.
Yeah.
But it's also a dumb movie to watch because it's basically Heart of Darkness mixed with Garden State in outer space. Because at the end of the day, it's all this lovely tech and all this beautiful cinematography in the service of a white guy learning to be okay with Tommy Lee Jones. I don't want to talk about it. Who cares? But you know what's coming up? Halloween.
Yeah, absolutely. And not just the Halloween sequels to the Jason Blum produced Halloween 2018. So,
nice tie.
There we go, folks. So basically technology, them's the breaks.
Well, it'll be interesting to see where it goes and just how, you know, films like Gemini Man, whether that'll encourage or deter, whether or not, you know, people like James Cameron, who seem to be, treating film projects like long-term investments, whether that pays off. It's an interesting time. It's always an interesting time.
Yeah,
Pete Sessions got a subpoena today. So, I mean, you never know what the world's going to bring you.
Absolutely. And Kevin Feige now runs Marvel Comics as well as the studio. So,
yeah, not bad for a Tuesday.
Yeah, absolutely. But yes, Halloween. So, yes, because we don't want to... Because, you know, we don't really get time to talk about all sorts of other things on our regular episodes here. With the season coming up here, I think it was fair to sit there and say that, you know, we enjoy Halloween. I certainly do. I prep for it every year well in advance. Shocker of shockers, I know. What about you, Andrew? How is the season for you?
Well, I like candy, and Charlotte loves trick-or-treating, and I'm always big fan of going with her. I can't wait until she is older because I have played two different Marx Brothers, and I would like to do all four before I die.
All right then. So yeah, so in the that's definitely, levels of dedication there. But of course, Halloween is a time in many instances for people to watch movies. Like, there is an appropriate time in a year to do that. But this one in
People watch
particular.
horror movies. What are some good Halloween horror movies is what we're trying to say.
Well,
Dave,
yeah.
any recent recommendations or old faves from the vault?
One of the ones I recently checked out for that I'm not necessarily going to give an unqualified recommendation to is Nightmare Cinema, the recent anthology film produced and had one segment directed by Mick Garris. Andrew, you can begin rolling your eyes right about now, but.
It's fine if you're making movies on television and, Stephen King can't get Frank Darabont to come down.
Well, I think we're well past the era of the Darabont and Garris era of King works, it seems. We're now into the Mike Flanagan era. But the key thing here is this is a film that, yes, is directed by Mick Garris, Alejandro Bruges, Joe Dante, Ryui Kitamura, and David Slade.
Okay, that's a good lineup.
It is a good lineup, and it is an interesting collection of films put together that are basically held together by scotch tape of a wraparound segment starring Mickey Rourke as the projectionist.
Oh man, that's gonna be so bad.
Well, it's the thing where
Angel Heart era Mickey Rourke, so good. Mickey Rourke as the projectionist. I'm just an old broken down piece of celluloid.
see, if they had at least done that, I would be far more down with it. The problem is, the projectionist is a nothing character. Like, the thing is, if you're gonna have a horror host for your wraparound segments, I am all in for it. But you need to make them distinctive, entertaining, and yeah, they should probably be
Or at least a
bordering.
whole bunch of really groan-inducing puns.
Well, yeah, like, there should be something where you almost lean into the camp of it. And I mean, if you want to do something like, watch, for example, the sequel to Tales from the Hood that came out last year with Dave, or with Keith David as the host in that one. I mean, yeah, that's fun stuff, people. Go see that. Yeah, Mickey Rourke gets nothing, absolutely nothing to do. And there are, I would say, of the five general segments that make up the film, I would say three of them are worthwhile. Certainly Joe Dante, I don't think he's adapted well to shooting on digital, but his segment's at least fun and has Richard Chamberlain in it, so
Sounds promising.
right there. And David Slade puts everybody to shame with how gorgeous his segment is. Like, he full on makes an art house little horror short with his film, which looks completely out of place with everything that surrounds it, which in terms of tone and style.
Will you say that he elevates the genre?
I won't say that he elevates the genre, but it's like, okay, he probably had the exact same amount of money, and he stretched that dollar so much farther than anybody else in terms of what he pulls off on a visual level with his segment. And then, unfortunately, Mick Garris's segment ends the film, and it's dull. It's just really, really dull.
Yeah, what King story did he adapt for that one?
None in this instance, which is probably the bigger problem.
Okay, what Joe Hill story did he adapt?
It was not a Joe Hill story either. I think this was an original of his. So, yeah, that's what you need to be prepared for. I feel bad for making fun of Mick Garris, but it's kind of hard not to.
He's got more money than you do, man. Let's not forget that celebrities more often than not are basically aliens in terms of how well they relate to day-to-day living.
True, true. But I would say, I mean, if you're looking for something new-ish to watch this year, I mean, it's not a bad one. Like I said, three out of the five segments are really worth the time, and the one set in a Catholic school is in particular pretty gonzo. I will say that. It is a demon possession story that throws any sense of good taste out the window very quickly. So if that sounds like it's up your alley, by all means, check that one out. What about you, Andrew? Anything that you want to sort of highlight in this instance?
Not really. I'm actually hard pressed to think of recent horror films that I've seen. Yeah, I don't know. It
Yeah.
Follows. Watch that because more people need to. It's good. I'll fight you on it. Let's see. It is a lot clunkier than most people would have you believe. The descent is super good. And yeah, the innocence, because kids are never as creepy as they were in 1960s England.
Well, and actually speaking of kids, I guess you have a slightly different issue than I do, because the thing is, I'm a swinging single, minus the swinging. All right.
A seafaring man.
Look, I'm a guy who lives in a basement and just eats his sadness. All right, folks, you happy? You broke me. Point of the matter being, I don't have to worry about what I'm watching, whether it will impact small children or that whether they wander into the room and see it. I don't have to relive my childhood trauma of watching the opening 5 minutes of The Twilight Zone as a 5-year-old because I wanted to sit there and watch a
Oh,
movie with mom
I
and
was just
dad.
thinking about that. Yeah, almost as traumatizing as the movie was for a couple other 5-year-olds.
Oh my, really?
Well, okay, it's the time of year of morbidity, but I guess well, actually, honestly, it's one of those things where Charlotte is not always with me. And the thing is, she watches movies with her mother, and some of it is stuff that I would think would be kind of on the upper limit of what most 8-year-olds could handle. Things like Coraline, where it's not outright horror, but there's something deeply creepy about it. But so far, what I've learned is that in watching anything, I mean, obviously, I'm not going to put on The Exorcist or The Omen for my precious little Charlotte, but I think really what it comes down to is contextualizing films and watching them with your kids. And honestly, I mean, ages aside, I think it comes down to parents knowing what is suitable for their kids and whether or not a conversation is required to make things sensible or palatable. Like, if you've got a 12-year-old that's self-conscious, don't watch The Brood, okay? Just use some common sense. Dave, you probably, though, have seen a lot more movies than I have. Anybody that wants a good recommendation for ones that are parent-kid friendly?
An oldie but a goodie, and one that I seems to be actually reasonably available right now if you're touring around, is The Adventures of Ichabod and Mr. Toad, Disney's shorter length live action feature film, which, yes, on one hand, adapts the adventure Wild Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, which, okay, that's maybe not so much of a Halloween one. The adaptation they did of Sleepy Hollow, though, hell yes, absolutely delightful and right on the cusp of, I think, what would probably be appropriate for most younger kids in terms of creepy imagery and sort of nightmarish stuff to be dealing with.
Well, okay, if they can handle Night on Bald Mountain, just kidding, no kids watch Fantasia,
Boo.
except for us when we were like 10. And that's probably why we have a podcast.
I mean, that's certainly up there. I mean, I would say, I mean, Paranorman, if those who, if you haven't seen that film, that one is a pure delight, for slightly older kids. I'd say probably about the 7 or 8 range is where it's going to be okay. I wouldn't necessarily go any younger for that. But again, it's from the same studio that produced Kubo and the, oh, what was the subtitle of that one?
Kubo and the Red Flower?
No, it was something
No, I'm thinking of
strings.
Mary and the Witch's Flower, which is also good. It's not horror, but it's Studio Ghibli, not Miyazaki. But we recently added that to the collection. It's a good sort of spooky movie to watch with your kids. It's also very well animated.
Excellent. But yeah, I mean, certainly, so that one's another recommendation you can add, and certainly Paranorman, if you haven't seen that. That one still has the probably the best people talking of the theater story I have ever experienced.
All right, spill it.
Okay, so basically, okay, for those who haven't seen the film, it's a animated film about a kid who, is able to see and talk with ghosts wherever he goes. And he's also a bit of a horror junkie, and the whole film involves actually some pretty grim subject matter in terms of, if you're familiar with things like the Salem's Witch Trial, yeah, imagine that and now have an entire town turning against a kid. That becomes important in this film. Point being here that as I'm watching this, I'm there, and a couple women come in front of me with a kid who had to have been maybe 5 at this point in time.
Okay.
And right as the credits start playing, You get, if those who've been to a Cineplex theater, you've seen those, you know, please put your phones away or set them on silent ads. And, you know, God bless the young at heart, because his immediate reaction was to turn to his mother and say, "Mom, make sure your phone's off." And good on you, kid. Good on you. But as the film goes on, you know, it was fascinating to see, because he would voice his reactions out loud. Like, he wasn't trying to be disrespectful or anything, but he was just like, "Oh, I'm scared. Oh, I'm not scared. Oh, I'm scared. I'm not scared." And rather than annoy me, I was actually kind of fascinated, because this film does play with some really creepy imagery. And at one point, though, you know, while this is going on, the kid suddenly turns to, again, presumably his mother, and says, "I wish Dad were here with us." And immediately in the back of my mind, there are at least three distinct possibilities for what that means.
Okay, Dad is dead, Dad went out for cigarettes, or Dad's at home and doesn't like movies.
Precisely. I want to hope it's the last one as opposed to one of the other two. Either way, though, it's just one of those things where it's like, yeah, never have I wanted to ask a question to get clarification more, where it would be, you know, totally, utterly inappropriate to do so.
Well, I mean, that's when, if Mom was really thinking on her feet, she would have looked over the kid's shoulder and be like, "But he is right there. I can see him." And then the kid will spend the rest of his life being like, "I'm like Paranorman, except I'm like Paramelvin."
Okay. But yeah, so basically, I'm not necessarily going
to... Why would you take away that small boy's sense of accomplishment and individuality, David?
Because I don't want to see the poor kid in therapy for years if we're having...
Well, how ironic that it's Halloween, because you have exposed yourself as the greatest monster of all.
Yeah, that's not the worst thing I've ever been said about me, so I'll take it. But yeah, so I would say that those are some fairly safe recommendations. There's always Ernest Scared Stupid as well, if you want to really go that road.
Which is also the title of my forthcoming confessional piano album. Except there's commas between all the words.
I see. Ernest Scared Stupid. All right, yeah, I can see this working. But yeah, so any other recommendations from you, Andrew, for the more kid-friendly fare?
Not really. I mean, use some common sense. That's all it takes. If it scares you, it's going to scare your kids. So just keep that in mind. Sometimes it's good to be scared, like on a roller coaster. Sometimes it's not, like a guy jumping out of an alley and asking for your wallet. So yeah, I think we've chewed up enough time this week, though.
Yeah.
Dave, you got anything to plug? Any parting words?
Nothing to plug, but I would like to say congrats to Kevin Feige.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a long time coming, and hopefully he will use his power responsibly. But yes, yeah, so whether in the community or whether in the cinema itself, I guess you could say it's a bit of a scary time. See, we tied it together. Now this episode is justified.
There we go, folks. So, until our next regular episode, which I'm sure you're all praying for at this point in time, Andrew, do you have any parting words you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Why, yes, David, I do. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
If you're lucky, though, monotony will certainly shoot your death in 120 frames per second 3D. It will look spectacular.
Yeah, they might have forgiven John Landis if he had. Day in, day out, day in, day out, day in, day out, day in, day out.